Welcome to a special edition of the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, we take a break from some of the politics of the week to talk about the issue of sports with perhaps the most decorated sports broadcaster ever. Bob Costas has won 29 Emmys, including being the only person to ever win an Emmy for news, sports, and entertainment. He's been National Sports Broadcaster of the Year more times than you can count. He broadcast 12 Olympics, 10 NBA Finals, 7 Super Bowls, 7 World Series in more than 40 years with NBC Sports. He has also had a long-running association with HBO, hosting shows for them, talk shows, not sports-related, and done news programming as well. I mean, he's had an extraordinary career, one of the greats ever. And this week, we had a chance to sit down with him. The occasion was a event for the Orange County Youth Sports Foundation. They asked me to MC. A special shout out to Joey from their crew that did that. And I asked Bob, I said, look, while we're doing this, you know how it can be hard to book a show. So I'm going to ask you if you'll do ours. And he said, yes. And so we got together at the resort at the Pelican Hill after this luncheon honoring him, this beautiful spot that turned into an incredibly windy day, so windy that a fire started nearby shortly after we finished this conversation. But I got this chance to talk to one of my broadcast heroes, and this is the full conversation, and we went a lot longer than TV would allow, so you're getting a lot of bonus content in this podcast, and we're going to present this conversation with no breaks. Here it is, our conversation with the great Bob Costas. Bob Costas, it is an honor. Welcome to The Issue Is.
Thank you, Alex. What is The Issue, Alex?
Well, that's what part of what I was going to ask you. So,
all right.
So you are like one of the greatest interviewers of all time. What would you ask you?
What are you doing here? Haven't we seen enough of you? Haven't we heard enough of you?
No, that's
when will you be done?
No, of course that's not true. We know, of course, baseball is your passion. That's what first got you excited about sports in the first place, and you're still so involved with baseball.
Mm-hmm.
When you started with baseball, baseball was America's pastime. It's not anymore.
Yes.
Football is clearly where most Americans spend their time. How does baseball get back there, or can it get back there?
I don't know that it can ever get back to the position of primacy that it once had, but baseball doesn't have to go way back. It doesn't have to go back to when people arrived wearing suits and on streetcars and women got into games for a quarter on Ladies' Day. They could go back to the relatively recent past. If you took steroids out
Bob
of it,
Costas,
in
it
the
is
90s
an honor.
And
to
the early
is.
2000s, the various elements of the game were in better balance than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
Home runs are fine, strikeouts are fine, but it's out of whack now. And the other elements, the triple, the hit and run, the stolen base, the ball in the gap and the guy's trying to score from first, the diving play by the shortstop, which has been reduced because shifts make what used to be difficult plays or automatic base hits into routine ground balls.
Mm-hmm.
So among the things they can do is try to go back to the future, so to speak, but not that far back,
mm-hmm.
a generation ago, maybe, and get the elements in better balance. I think that they ought to, and they're on the verge of doing it, eliminate shifts starting next year, meaning you have to have at least two infielders on either side of second base, and their cleats have to be on the dirt. I think they should also seriously consider limiting the number of pitchers on the roster so it slows the parade of pitchers coming out of the bullpen.
You know, at the same time, here in California, we are seeing historic things happen when it comes to baseball. Not far from where we are here in Orange County, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim already had Mike Trout, perhaps once in a generation player. And then they get Shohei Ohtani, who is an all-star pitcher and an all-star hitter.
He's a unicorn.
Put him in some historical context.
Well, there is no comparison in our lifetime. And even Babe Ruth, who would have been a Hall of Famer as a pitcher had he just remained a pitcher, never was doing the two simultaneously at the same level.
Mm.
There were occasional times when he took to the mound in the 1920s, but those were almost like sideshow things. He was doing his Hall of Fame pitching before he became a full-time outfielder. Nobody in the modern history of the game has done what Shohei Ohtani has done at this level. There have been people like Rick Ankiel, who started as a pitcher, had control troubles despite a great arm, and became an outfielder. But again, nothing that rivals what Ohtani has done.
And up the freeway are the Los Angeles Dodgers. Mm-hmm. Their roster is loaded. I mean,
it is.
Almost everybody on the team is an all-star. Is that good for baseball to have that many good players on one team?
Well, it is good for baseball, generally speaking, if teams in major markets do well. It goes without saying, even with reduced baseball ratings now, because baseball has become more a local or regional sport than a national sport, if the Dodgers were to play the Yankees in the World Series, and if they met the Mets, let's say, in the LCS on the way there, that would help baseball ratings.
So we had Joe Davis on the show a few weeks ago, and I said to him the Dodgers have amassed the 2022 All-Star team. The Lakers have amassed the 2009 All-Star team.
Yeah, right.
Unfortunately.
Right. I remember saying to Carmelo Anthony before the season began, I don't know if this is the Lakers 2022 roster or an old-timers game.
Yeah.
You know, all these guys were great, Hall of Fame great at one time or another. Maybe this just isn't the time.
I mean, can you get around that? Is there a way to mix and match the pieces this summer to maybe make that team a championship contender?
Well, they can't come back as presently constituted. And, of course, as you get older, no matter how well-conditioned these guys are, you get injury problems. Anthony Davis is a relatively younger player, and he's had injury issues throughout his career. So basketball has always been a question of having parts that fit in a jigsaw. Having five really good players does not automatically mean you have a great starting five in terms of how they gel. So they know that. They've got to reconfigure it.
Can you remember a team that had such high expectations and such low performance?
In basketball? Not off the top of my head, no. Yeah. You know, they had won. It was in the bubble, but they had won the championship in 2020. They had LeBron. You know, Russell Westbrook has his history. Anthony Davis has his history. Carmelo Anthony has his history. Yeah, it all looked good on paper until you went to the column with the ages.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about the NFL right now. News this week is that Tom Brady is being hired by Fox Sports to be the lead analyst whenever he retires, which could be 5 years from now, who knows?
Right.
And that he could end up broadcasting Super Bowls. Potentially a 10-year deal. Mm-hmm. Is that a good deal? Is that worth it? Does that make sense?
Well, I think it puts Tom and Giselle over the top, so I don't have to worry about their future as I once did. So there's that. Here's where it can make sense. When you take a look at the big picture, this only applies to football. Whoever would be a comparably great hockey, basketball, or baseball announcer, comparably great to Al Michaels or Joe Buck, the market isn't there. Mm-hmm. Those sports, popular as they may be, don't move the needle the way football does. 75 of the 100 top-rated television programs of the last year were NFL games, and topped by the biggest. The top 10 is all NFL games. Plus, you now have five platforms spending billions upon billions of dollars for the rights fees and the production costs. Mm-hmm. So even though $15 million for a color man or analyst or play-by-play man seems like a lot, it's really coming out of the petty cash drawer. If you didn't spend that for the person who's going to be the face of your coverage for the most important property, not just in sports, but in all of entertainment, it would be like buying a $10,000 tuxedo, if such a thing exists, and then not paying for the shoes and the tie and the pocket silk. It's all just accessory stuff. Now, Tom Brady's numbers even dwarf Tony Romo and some of the others, but he's Tom Brady. Mm-hmm. He moves the needle. People who don't know a screen pass from a field goal know who Tom Brady is. He brings glamour as well as credibility. And the way I understand it is that he's going to be a kind of corporate ambassador for Fox in addition to the football commentary. So if you can tell potential sponsors and your corporate partners or whatever, yeah, we're going to lunch. Tom Brady will be there. Yeah, we're having our little gathering in Boca Raton or whatever it is, and Tom Brady will be there. That has huge business value to you.
Tom Brady, obviously one of the greatest quarterbacks ever, probably the greatest quarterback ever, but he's never broadcasted
That's
before.
That's right.
What would your advice be to him if you were sitting next to him in the broadcast booth?
Well, he's going to be sitting next to Kevin Burkhardt, who is a very fine broadcaster, but Kevin himself is embarking upon his first season as the number one broadcaster for Fox. So if he were sitting next to Jim Nance or Al Michaels or Joe Buck, they might have more experience at that level to impart. I know Kevin will be very good at it. What they always tell all of us, I'm sure they told you this, be yourself, which is good advice, except you can't be yourself until you're confident that you've got the basic nuts and bolts down. And while Tom is a very smart guy, and he's very well spoken when he's interviewed, and when he wants to be open, he can be. Like the man in the arena, he's much more open than he generally has been in interviews on network television. So we know he can be candid when he wants to be. But there's a difference between being a good interview and being a good broadcaster. And the history of network TV sports is strewn with the names of first ballot Hall of Famers who were brought on because of their fame and did not turn out to be good broadcasters. Right. I won't embarrass anybody by naming them, but you can think of them off the top of your head.
It'd be fun if you did.
So it doesn't, it's a good play because it will make an impact.
Yeah.
And it's hard to believe that he won't be at least pretty good because he's Tom Brady. But will he be objectively as good as a Chris Collinsworth or a Tony Romo? We don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see.
The thing that a lot of people associate you first and foremost with is the Olympics, of course. You've broadcast 12 different Olympic Games. The last few Olympics, not a lot of people have watched, or at least the ratings have gone way down. To say not a lot of people watch is unfair. Last few Olympics, the ratings have gone way down than when you were there. There's a lot of reasons for that, including the pandemic and the countries that they were in and changes in broadcasting itself and all of that. But do you think that going forward, the Olympics will still be able to keep up the same level of relevance that it had when you were there? Has the games gotten too political?
Well, first of all, you can't attribute the higher ratings relatively when I was there to me. I was just the beneficiary, you know.
Right.
I happened to broadcast, for example, the highest rated game and series in NBA history in 1998, the Jazz and the Bulls. I'm thinking Michael Jordan had much more to do with that than me. I was just trying not to mess it up, you know.
Don't tell your agent that.
But NBC, in fairness, was dealt a terrible hand the last couple of Olympics. The Olympics in Tokyo, pandemic circumstances, no fans and families there in the stands. And then there was resentment, and rightly so, toward the IOC and toward China. When I broadcast the Beijing Olympics in 2008, I made the point that China had a terrible human rights record. In 1996, in Atlanta, I pointed out that they were trying to get the Olympics. They hadn't yet been granted 2008, but that there were serious issues with human rights, with the threat to Taiwan, with intellectual property. All these things were issues. Mm-hmm. I did that in 1996, and through Chinese Communist Party, there was a campaign in the United States to have me fired, or short of being fired, to offer some sort of public apology, a quote, sincere public apology in prime time. So I was aware of it then. Some people who paid attention were aware of it then. But by 2022, I think it was common knowledge, even among people who aren't news junkies, it was common knowledge that China is among the world's worst human rights abusers. And so there was real resentment toward the hosts and toward the IOC for going back there yet again when they'd already been there in 2008. And between that and the pandemic and people's changed viewing habits with people migrating to streaming and all the rest, it's really not fair to judge NBC given those circumstances. The chance they'll have to get their groove back comes in 2024 in Paris, where they'll have the ideal setting, the perfect backdrop, and we would hope that things are closer to normal. Whether Olympic ratings can ever get back to where they once were, there's so many overlapping circumstances, hard to say. But there should be a significant bounce back in 2024.
And in 2028, the Olympics come to Southern California.
Yes.
Are you worried about the IOC? Are you worried that the games can get there? Are you worried about some of the issues behind the scenes for the games here?
Well, it looks like for the foreseeable future, the IOC will not be directly involved with some of the world's most objectionable regimes. And if you're going to have a Summer Olympics in the United States, Los Angeles might be the best place for it because you have the venues already there. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to have the circumstances that some host cities have faced where they go to all the expense, the infrastructure and the stadiums and the arenas and the venues, and then those venues sit empty.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they don't play that much baseball in Greece or whatever it might be. You know, so the weeds are growing and they go bankrupt or close to it. I think that Los Angeles has a chance to be very successful, both in terms of hosting it and having it make financial sense.
So at the Olympics, you got to profile Michael Phelps over and over again as he became the greatest Olympian of all time.
Or at least the most decorated.
Yeah. And then with the NBA, you were there for all of Michael Jordan's championships as well. What is it about these guys, about the greatest of the greatest in person, that you learned from them that other people aren't doing? Because everybody at the professional level is a good player. What makes them great?
Well, you have to start with superior talent. But then you have to have the commitment and the will to take that to its absolute nth degree. Michael Jordan was not satisfied after winning a championship. You hear guys say, I just need a ring. I'm in pursuit of a ring. If he could have, he would have wanted 16 rings, not six. So you have that. Same thing with Phelps. You have to have that single-minded commitment. And so much of what makes a champion or a championship moment is done in preparation. The competition is the fulfillment of all that preparation, the training, the practice, especially when you talk about Olympians. Because in the United States, most people do not pay attention to the core sports of the Olympics except for those 3 weeks every 4 years. You know, it might be a big deal to be a cross-country skier in Norway or a race walker in Romania or something, but not so much in the United States. Even Michael Phelps, who remains a sports icon. If you said, we're going to have Michael Phelps a week after the 2012 Olympics jump into a pool in Baltimore against the very same competition, that wouldn't get much of a rating. In the context of the Olympics and all that that implies, then America was transfixed by that. So all that preparation, when you're talking about people who spend years and years in the shadows and then step onto the biggest platform in all of global sports, that's part of what gives the Olympics its drama, its mystique, whatever you want to call it. That's what redeems it. Right. Despite all the issues and the issues we may have with the IOC, what redeems it is that reality.
Is Michael Jordan the biggest star you've ever covered?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Even more so than Tom Brady. Peyton Manning is a wonderful personality in addition to being a great player. You know how terrific he is in commercials and how genuinely funny he is. I mean, he has a real comedian's timing.
Yeah.
I texted him after a recent appearance he had on SNL where he was a surprise contributor to Weekend Update. I said, did these guys ask you to give them lessons in comedic timing?
Yeah.
You know, but I think that with Jordan, there's the confluence of it. When he comes along, the NBA, take me out of it, the NBA is on NBC. Mm-hmm. It's now essentially a cable entity.
Mm-hmm.
Not only were all those championships on in prime time on a broadcast network, but the promos were on Seinfeld and Cosby and ER and Johnny Carson's Tonight Show and David Letterman. He was part of the cultural conversation in a way, and the Dream Team comes along in 1992, the real Dream Team, and sports marketing is just taking off. Athletes had done commercials before, but now you have Nike and the whole thing is in very high gear. I want to be like Mike. And he wasn't just a great player. He's telegenic, you know, he has a certain kind of presence. And I've given this answer before, and I mean it as no disrespect to LeBron James. You can't have a discussion of a tiny handful of greatest players without LeBron James being in that discussion. But this, I think, is a fair statement. No little old lady in Omaha ever said, I'm sorry, Mildred, I can't play bridge tonight. I got to watch LeBron James. But a million little old ladies like that who didn't know a pick and roll from a three-pointer said, hey, I'm watching Michael Jordan. I don't know who's on the Trailblazers, but I'm watching Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
So his impact, I think, was greater than any athlete that I've covered.
Mildred wanted to be like Mike.
Mildred wanted to be like Mike.
And you've also gotten to witness some of the great sports broadcasters. I would say you're the greatest
national sports broadcaster of all time.
Well,
here in California, we think that Vin Scully is the greatest local sports broadcaster of all time. You got to work with Vin closely and learn from him. What did you learn from Vin?
Well, I think I learned from Vin what Vin learned from Red Barber, preparation. Vin liked to quote the great actor Sir Laurence Olivier, "You have to have the humility to prepare, but then the confidence to bring it off." Not everything you prepare comes to bear on a broadcast. You don't know. You prepare many times over what you'll actually use, but you want all of it there just in case. And then when you've been around a while, it isn't just the things you've specifically prepared for that particular event. A lot of it is what's in the back of your head because of what you've seen and experienced. Think of Vin toward the end of his glorious career, and something would happen in a game and it would just remind him of something that Leo Durocher said, or that Jackie Robinson did, or that Don Drysdale or Sandy Koufax did. That's something that no one, no matter how good, unless they've been around all that time, can bring to bear. And Vin, of course, it wasn't just local. Obviously, his greatest fame is with the Dodgers, but he did the game of the week and a lot of World Series on both radio and television for NBC. He also did football for CBS, and he was great at that because he was great at everything. He was great at golf, but there's never been a better baseball broadcaster than Vin Scully.
And, of course, one of the great national moments that he did was with you in 1988, perhaps the greatest moment in the history of the Dodgers franchise, Kirk Gibson's home run, and you're in the dugout.
Yeah, I was the pregame and postgame guy along with Marv Albert. And I was supposed to do an interview with somebody on the Dodgers when that game ended. Then reporters weren't allowed in the dugout. Now it's all about access, but then technically you weren't allowed. But Lasorda and the Dodgers players knew me. So I snuck into the corner of the dugout so that I'd have a view of the game and also be ready to jump right out on the field no matter what happened. So in about the seventh or eighth inning, I hear a sound from down the tunnel. And it's like thwack, thwack. So I go down to investigate. And it's Gibson, who had been on the trainer's table, not dressed, wasn't introduced before the game. I actually opened the broadcast by saying, first item of business, Kirk Gibson will not play tonight. He's not available for even pinch hitting duty. He won't be introduced. He won't suit up. That's that. Naturally, Vin Scully, with his sense of drama, kept alluding to it. And he asked Harry Coyle, the great director, to pan the dugout. No Kirk Gibson, no Kirk Gibson. So now you got a story. No matter how it plays out, he's framing that story. And the drama of it is building no matter how it pays off. So it turns out that Gibson hears Vin Scully say for the fourth or fifth time, no Kirk Gibson. And being the competitor that he was, he says, screw this, jumps off the table, pulls on his uniform, goes down with a bat boy, and he's hitting baseballs off a tee. And I can hear him grunting. So I go down to look. I see what's happening. I get on the telex to Mike Weissman in the truck, and I say, he's taking swings. Maybe he can pinch hit. So he tips Vin and Joe Garagiola off. And then he comes up, and it's so dramatic, and it matters that the count went to 3-2, and he fouled off some pitches, and he backed out of the box. That let the drama build. And nobody was better at that than Vin Scully. You know, there have been a lot of great announcers where if you take the call of the play itself, the home run, the great catch, the strikeout, so that could be comparable to Vin's call of that. But he was incomparable when it came to everything that led up to it. If you listen to the whole ninth inning of Sandy Koufax's perfect game in 1965, if you had a month to write it, you couldn't improve it by a comma. It's stunning how good that is. And it's all the buildup. What if he didn't get it? What if Harvey Keene got a base hit? It's still brilliant because he framed it. And he framed all of that drama with Kirk Gibson. And the way it was cut by Harry Coyle in the truck, it was like it was a movie. So now it's over. And I say to the pregame producer, David Neal, this is my sole contribution to all this. I did interview Gibson on the field afterwards, but it was boilerplate stuff. It was just the emotion of the moment. I say, you know, that reminded me of Robert Redford's last at-bat as Roy Hobbs in The Natural. And David took it from there, and he intercut Redford's at-bat with Gibson's at-bat. And it was eerie how they mirrored each other, including Wilford Brimley as the manager of the New York Knights, jumping up like Lasorda jumped up, and they looked the same, and they both got about that far off the ground. And that's how we came on the air before game two. And people just raved about it. I heard about it years and years later. And Kirk Gibson himself has said that the way he recalls that moment is partially how it felt while he was doing it, but also in large part how it felt to watch Vin's call and to watch that pregame piece from the next night. So that shows you how, if we do our job well, and that was 90% Vin, but whatever tiny part others played in it, if you do your job well, then it shapes how people remember these moments. If you don't have Al Michaels saying, "Do you believe in miracles?" Yes. Is it still a great moment? Of course it is. Is it remembered the way it is still? Of course not.
Yeah, and of course we remember your call specifically in 1998. The last dance, you're the guy with the last word on Michael Jordan's last shot. Of course, he goes to the Wizards, but he prefers to forget that.
That's
as
a footnote.
Most sports people.
Right.
One of the great moments in NBA history. What's going through your mind as he takes that shot?
Well, you know that there's a good chance that this is the end of the road for the Bulls dynasty and for Michael Jordan's NBA career. You don't know it for sure, but you know there's a chance. So you're mindful of that. But it's also a close game that's playing out, and the Jazz have the lead until the last few seconds. And if they win, Game 7 is on their floor. Mm-hmm. So the whole script could be torn up. So when he makes the shot with 5 seconds to go, Doug Collins and Isaiah Thomas analyze what's happened, how the play unfolded. But I had to be mindful that this wasn't just a great sports moment. This wasn't just the cover of Sports Illustrated. It's the cover of Time and Newsweek. It's the front page of the LA Times and the New York Times, not just the sports page. So it was my job to have a bigger picture notion. And what I said, and thankfully it held up 20 years later or more with The Last Dance, I said that may have been the last shot that Michael Jordan will ever take in the NBA. I had to qualify it. Who knows what will unfold in the next few months. And if that's the last image of Michael Jordan, how magnificent is it? And luckily for me, our people in the truck were so good. Andy Rosenberg, such a good director, that as I was saying that, he matched it perfectly, and this is live, he matched it perfectly to a slow motion replay where, as I said, how magnificent is it? The ball was rippling through the net. You know, you just can't beat that. That's the collaboration of it.
We are talking to Bob Costas, one of the great sportscasters of all time. Here on The Issue is we do something called personal issues.
Yes.
This is where we do real quick rapid fire.
I have so many personal issues, really. How much time do you have, Alex?
I'm not a therapist,
At least you're not charging me an exorbitant amount to lie on a couch.
This is quick hit stuff. Yeah. First thing that comes to mind.
Yeah.
What is your favorite TV show right now?
Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Oh, great call. What is your favorite ballpark concession? Best thing to eat at a ballpark?
The bratwurst with secret stadium sauce at Miller Park, used to be County Stadium in Milwaukee.
Okay, got to try that. If you had a walk-up song and you were going up to bat, what would that be?
Yikes. You know, I should have an answer for that, shouldn't I?
Maybe the Ludacris rap where he talks about you.
I'd be rolling torpedoes, get blunted with Rastas, and for a hefty fee I'm on your record, like Bob Costas. Now, of course, my street cred was already sky high, given Pootie Tang and other aspects of my career, but that may have put me over the top. So, yeah, we'll go with Luda.
That is the first time Pootie Tang's been referenced on The Issue.
Yeah. Wadate, my brother, Wadate.
Favorite book?
You know, like a lot of things, music, your favorite ball players, it's what strikes you when you're young. So like a million other adolescent boys, I like The Catcher in the Rye. I related to Holden Caulfield, so it's still one of my favorites.
Since we're at a golf course, Nicklaus or Tiger?
Well, the case for Nicklaus is not just the 18 majors, but the fact that he finished second in majors 19 times. That's an incredible thing. There you have a combined 37 between first and second. So that's the case for Nicklaus. But I think it can fairly be said, and I think Jack would agree with this, that nobody was ever better than Tiger in that little 5 or 6 year period of time, late 90s to early 2000s. His peak Tiger is as good as it ever got.
And who's your role model?
Well, Vin was always a role model. The combination of qualities that he brought to it was unmatched. I've never tried to copy anybody. I think if you copy someone, you're just a pale imitation, but you can be influenced by them. So I was influenced by Jim McKay. He had a great combination of a literate touch, but also boyish enthusiasm. He just combined things very well in his own way. But I didn't try to copy him, but I learned some things from him.
And of course, Jim McKay hosted the Olympics before you did.
He told me, as I was embarking on my first one as the primetime host in 1992 in Barcelona, he said, keep this in mind. Yes, it's a great sports event, but it's also a travelogue. It's also a cultural panorama. People want to know the human stories and the varied backgrounds and circumstances that these people come from.
Well, in terms of the question of who's your role model, for me, you are one of my role models and one of the best to ever do it. I've watched your stuff for years and studied you, and such a phenomenal interviewer as well. And it is such an honor, honestly, to have you on the show and to learn from you. And thank you for being so kind to us.
You're too kind, and good luck editing that Kirk Gibson story. Yeah. It's a good story. It's a program unto itself. I see it as bonus material. You can get it streaming if you want to subscribe to Alex Page. He can make a little extra cash out of it. Really, do it.
Yeah, and what's your advice to broadcasters like me?
Keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, you can't teach tall. That's something I didn't have going for me, but I got by anyway.
Yeah, it seemed to work out okay. Bob Costas.
Thank you,
Alex.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you very much.
Really, really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
This is so fun.
Our thanks to Bob Costas, and there's a little bit of bonus material after the bonus material. After we finished interviewing, I thought of another question about who is his Mount Rushmore of broadcasting. Here's that.
If you had a Mount Rushmore of the greatest guests that you've ever talked to, who's on that list?
Paul McCartney is on that list for sure, and it would have been a thrill no matter what, because I'm thinking it's 1991, so I'm 39 years old, and I'm thinking, I wonder if anyone I went to high school with is watching this now and saying, wait a minute, there's Bobby Costas talking to Paul McCartney. And at that time, Paul, who's a very genial and accessible guy, but it wasn't the way it is now where everybody seems to be available everywhere. He hadn't done a substantive American interview in quite some time. And we did a three-part later with him, which amounts to 66 minutes of content. And it's knocking around now on YouTube. And I still hear about it now from people who are discovering it for the first time or watching it again some 30 years later. And I guess it must have been pretty close to definitive, because people who are real fans of the Beatles seem to like it. That would be way up there. On a much more serious note, I guess people might talk about the Jerry Sandusky interview when he incriminated himself on national television as the Penn State scandal was unfolding. Mickey Mantle, when he came out of the Betty Ford Clinic on the NBC Primetime News magazine in the mid-90s, it's really something to, you talk about dreams come true. You grow up as a kid loving baseball, carry a Mickey Mantle baseball card from 1958 around with you even into your adult years, because it was the first Mickey Mantle card I ever got out of a Topps bubblegum pack. And you wind up not only knowing Mickey, but you wind up doing that interview, which was at a turning point in his life, and then his family asked you to do the eulogy at his funeral. I mean, if you ever dreamed of such things, it would be ridiculous. And yet so many of those things actually happened. So
that's three.
Fortunate.
You got one more spot.
Oh, I gave you one more spot. One more spot. I don't know that this list of four is really definitive, but it's what's occurring to me. So let's go with one that comes from an entirely different direction. Mary Lou Henner used to be on Taxi, you know, very lovely and humorous. This is late 1980s on Later. And Mary Lou Henner has this facility. I forget what the technical term for it is, but she can remember where she was every single day of her life. Or if you throw out to her, like you say, all right, November 23rd, 1992, she says, oh, that was a Tuesday, and blah, and then she tells you what she was doing, and it's all correct. It's like a savant's thing that she has. Okay, so I toss out a few dates as she's demonstrating this, and then I think, well, how about if I give her one where everybody knows where they were? And I'm thinking November 22nd, 1963 is too dark. So I say July 20th, 1969. We all remember where we were when men walked on the moon. What about you? And she goes, who told you this? So no one told me. I just picked it at random. Oh, come on. Who told you this? Then she starts twirling her hair with her index finger, you know, kind of a nervous tick, right? She starts and she stops, and like three or four times she says, who told you this? And I'm like, Mary Lou, I swear, I picked it at random. She goes, okay, that's the night I lost my virginity. And so I say, well, one thing we know for sure, Neil Armstrong wasn't the guy, right? And then everybody's laughing. There's no audience, but the cameraman and the stage manager, they're all laughing. And then with no further prompting, we'll see if we keep this in, with no further prompting, she goes, standing up in the shower. So I say, you know, Mary Lou, I have a feeling that this is something one would not forget, even if they didn't have this special facility, which you have. That seems to me to be kind of unforgettable. To which she agreed. Okay, now, I run into her years later. She says to me, of all the things I've done, I'm at a restaurant someplace, and people will come up to me and go, so where were you when men walked on the moon?
Yeah, standing up in the shower.
There you go.
Yeah, well done. Thank you so much.
There you have
it. That was fantastic.
Bob Costas, what a way to end the interview. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, we talk to the New York Times reporters behind one of the biggest books in all of the country, This Will Not Pass. Martin and Alex Burns will be with us. I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks for listening to the Issue Is podcast, and we'll see you next week.